Hi, science enthusiasts. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Science Podcast with Bunsen Burner. This is episode 5 of season 1. My name is Jason Sikowski. I'm your host. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, and I'm the dog dad of Bunsen. But in reality, I'm Bunsen's human. You can follow Bunsen's adorable science adventures on social media. On Twitter, he's Bunsen Burner BMD. Facebook and Instagram, he's BunsenBurner.BMD. He's also on TikTok if you're into that sort of crazy thing. In the description to the show, you'll find a link to our merch shop, which has a bunch of Bunsen gear, t-shirts and hoodies and other fun stuff with adorable cartoons of him on it and some really cute science sayings. I mean, it's good in the lab, it's good at a fancy dinner. Take a look at it. The podcast will also always be free. You don't have to worry about paying for it. And to offset some of the costs, we've set up a Patreon at Patreon.com/BunsenBurner. There's 3 different tiers. The lowest tier is $5 a month. And since we do about 3 or 4 podcasts a month, that's not a bad price to pay to support the show per podcast. Higher tiers have some pretty cool swag if you take a look at it. The highest tier will net you the Bunsen Burner stuffy that we're developing. There's pictures of it on social media. It is heart-meltingly adorable. It will come with a lab coat and little safety goggles, too. We have a show today that's near and dear to our hearts. It's all about dinosaurs. Dinosaur facts, dinosaur woo or wow, and we're interviewing a paleontologist from the Terrell Museum in Alberta, which is world-renowned for its dinosaur artifacts. We've been there many times. It is amazing. A lot of the artifacts when we were in New York at the Museum of Natural History were on loan from the Terrell Museum here in Alberta. Well, we might as well get to the show. Because there's no time like science time.
Oh boy, the science news this week is pretty exciting. So the story is about the Aurora Ceratops. And the Aurora Ceratops was originally found in the Gobi Desert. What is the Aurora Ceratops? It's a horned dinosaur, so it's kind of like the Triceratops. They have long, thin claws, and they have some other interesting features like curved femurs. The Aurora Ceratops is a little bit smaller than the Triceratops. It's about 1.25 meters tall and probably around 15 to 16 kilograms. So that's 49 inches tall or 34 pounds. It's got a really short frill and a beak. So it is a horned dinosaur, but it kind of lacks the true horn that you would be thinking about when you thought of the Triceratops. So the Aurora Ceratops is actually quite a bit smaller than the Triceratops. In fact, it wouldn't be that much bigger than Bunsen. Bunsen, would you like to play with an Aurora Ceratops?
The Aurora Ceratops lived approximately 115 million years ago, and they only found a few of them back in 2004. Findings were just released on 80 additional samples of the species, from hatchlings to adults. And we now know more about, or we will know more, or we have more evidence about these Aurora Ceratops than just about any other dinosaur. That big find, 80 new specimens that they found, has brought that species of dinosaur up to the top of dinosaurs we know the most about. So this is just a big deal. The findings were released. They found all of these really interesting species. The paleontologist Peter Dodson, he was a senior author on the work. He was pretty excited about all of this because when they found the dinosaur first in 2004, a lot of the paleontologists who looked at the bones figured it was like a very new kind that nobody ever saw before, kind of like a mini Triceratops.
So the team kept plugging away at the original discovery, and as they worked, they found more and more samples, which would bring it up to the aforementioned number that was found. Other crazy stuff about this species of dinosaurs was also put into the study. That it walked on 2 legs, not 4 like the Triceratops, but 2 legs.
Most dinosaurs that paleontologists study, and most dinosaurs that we know of, and the fossils that we see, only come from about 5 samples of that dinosaur. Dinosaur fossils are incredibly hard to find. So why is a discovery of a whole bunch of these Aurora Ceratops fossils such a big deal? Well, remember, in order for a dinosaur fossil to become a fossil, a whole bunch of things basically have to go perfectly correct. The dinosaur has to die. Pretty much right after it dies, it has to be covered up and protected, so it has to be preserved. And not only does it have to be crushed under rock over millions of years, but that dinosaur fossil has to be found by humans. So a lot of dinosaur fossils are found in deserts,
like the Gobi Desert, and near us, near the Royal Tyrrell Museum, kind of like in southern Alberta, along riverbanks, because there's very little vegetation. Who knows? There could be crazy dinosaur fossils everywhere, but it's really hard to see them when they're being, you know, there's trees growing on top of them and bushes. So it's way easier to see a leg of a dinosaur sticking out of the sand or out of the riverbank than, you know, a leg of a dinosaur that had a tree growing on top of it. On top of that, remember, the dinosaur fossils are buried deep under the ground. And those dinosaur fossils have to be brought to the surface. So there may be dinosaur fossils everywhere on Earth, plentiful, but they're just trapped way underground. And around where we live in North America, the ground has risen as the Rocky Mountains formed. So it's brought a lot of the fossils kind of up. Erosion helps too, but that's the main reason. I wonder if Bunsen would get along with dinosaurs. He really likes to be everybody's friend, even little dogs that want to bite him and even big dogs that want to bite him. So yeah, I think he'd try to be a dinosaur's friend. Maybe a little dinosaur like this Auroraceratops would be better than a great big, you know, truck-sized dinosaur that could hurt him if he got too close. And that's the science news for this week.
This part of the podcast is called I'll be giving you three statements. Two of them are false, one of them is true. We're changing things up a bit with woo or wow, and we're going to make sure that the statements and the facts are in line with what our expert is going to be talking about. So there's a theme for every podcast. I hope you enjoy the change. Here we go. So all of the statements this week are going to be about dinosaurs. Man, I love dinosaurs. I was a dinosaur nut when I was a kid. Okay, statement one. The velociraptors in Jurassic Park are heavily featured, both the original and the remake. So here's the statement. Velociraptors are no bigger than a chicken. Here's the second statement. Dinosaurs could live to be hundreds of years old. Boy, that's one old dinosaur. And here's the third statement. The Stegosaurus's plates were used to help cool it off instead of for protection. What was the Stegosaurus's name in The Land Before Time? I think it was Spike. Man, that show wrecks you in like the first 10 minutes. I remember watching that as a kid and being super disturbed. Spoiler alert. Let's recap. The first statement was about the size of the velociraptor. The second statement is about dinosaurs being incredibly long-lived. And the third statement is about the Stegosaurus's plate functions. Two of these statements are false, and only one is true. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Okay, time's up. Okay, let's talk about the Stegosaurus's plates and the statement that it used them to cool itself off. Now, this would be wow if we were using old research. There were studies done in the 1970s and around that time that seemed to show that, yes, the plates on the Stegosaurus definitely had a role in keeping the animal cool. There wasn't that much protection given to the animal from the plates because they weren't hard like the shell of an Ankylosaurus. The newest research seems to show that they probably were used as a display function, kind of like birds use when they're mating. I don't know if you've seen the birds do the crazy dance to attract mates, but that seems to be the prevailing theory. The current research just doesn't show enough evidence that the Stegosaurus used its plates to cool itself off, and it was debunked a while back that they don't use the plates for protection. Now, I would give anything to have David Attenbury narrate a Stegosaurus mating dance using its plates as some kind of like frilled feathers. That would be amazing. The Stegosaurus had a spiky tail that it could swing with deadly force, and they found giant carnivorous dinosaurs with damages to its body, like the Allosaurus, to kind of prove that they definitely had, you know, a rough go when they decided to try and eat a Stegosaurus. So going with the most up-to-date research, yeah, this one is woo. Okay. So with giving away the next one, that'll give away the one that's true and the one that's woo. The statement that is woo that's left is the lifespan of the dinosaurs. Previous evidence seemed to show that dinosaurs would be incredibly long-lived, like some reptiles on Earth are. However, we now know that dinosaurs didn't need to regulate their body temperature like lizards do. And most carnivorous dinosaurs, like the Tyrannosaurus rex, probably only lived to be about 30. And plant-eating dinosaurs probably lived double that, maybe triple. You might have one really old plant-eating dinosaur make it past 100, but The average lifespan was well below that. So when you're searching on the internet, there is debate on this, but the most up-to-date research agrees that the dinosaurs didn't live hundreds and hundreds of years old. They lived a normal lifespan for carnivorous creatures on Earth that had the same kind of physiology. So no super old Tyrannosaurus Rex walking around with a little cane with its little arms. This statement about dinosaurs being more than 100 years old or hundreds of years old is woo. So that brings us to the true statement. Velociraptors are only about the size of a chicken. Can you imagine how goofy it would be in Jurassic Park if they made the Velociraptor its correct size? Nobody would be frightened of those things. You could just kick them and you'd be done with it. The Velociraptor had to be scaled up because when the director was looking at, you know, putting the Velociraptor in there and he saw pictures of their actual size, Steven Spielberg, he was super disappointed. He's like, nobody's going to be scared of these things. So they scaled them up. Now, there is an animal about that size called the Utah Raptor. But it just doesn't have the same kind of name as Velociraptor. And then you don't have Sam Neill's character, Dr. Grant, you know, traumatizing that kid at the front of Jurassic Park with the Velociraptor claw. He's like, it will like rip your intestines out. And the kid's like, no, I hate dinosaurs. That's a pro tip for anybody who's a teacher out there. You know, you can use a little bit of sarcasm, but instilling fear into your students will probably make them not love science. That one's true. That one is a wow. Velociraptors are only about the size of a chicken or a turkey, some kind of small bird. Our guest on Ask an Expert today is Dr. Donald Henderson. He is a paleontologist at the Royal Tyrrell Museum. His research focus is all about dinosaurs. One of the things he's looking at lately is the rate of fossil erosion. In the future, he's going to be looking at how armored dinosaurs move, like the Stegosaurus and the Ankylosaurus. So we've got Dr. Donald Henderson here on the Science Podcast today. How are you doing, Donald?
I'm very well, thank you. What's it like eating red deer?
Well, we just had a crazy rainstorm that just went through, so I was kind of worried that actually it was hailing, so I thought that would come up.
Oh no, we had a major downpour last night, and there's another one tonight.
Oh wow.
Thunderstorm.
So same weather then.
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. I'm stammering a bit because I'm really, really excited to have you. When I was young, I actually wanted to be a paleontologist myself. Life went a different way, and I'm a chemistry teacher. But, man, your job is just so fascinating to so many people.
Every day I think how fortunate I am.
What some people don't maybe, well, I don't know. What is the background needed to become a paleontologist? Like, where did you get your training?
Well, I've always been interested in rocks since I was little. My mom says I was collecting rocks when I was three. Yeah, so I liked rocks, but I've also had a parallel interest in living reptiles and amphibians my whole life. And I still got a collection of reptiles and amphibians in aquaria and tanks at home and here in my office. And with paleo, I get to combine the two. My first degree was in geophysics because I was interested in the interiors of planets. But I always had this interest in the prehistoric past, the living past. And so I just kept plugging away at various university studies and eventually got a PhD in paleontology and biomechanics.
So that's how the dinosaurs moved, right? Like I was reading your bio, and one of the things you're going to be working on, unless your bio's changed on the museum site, is the biomechanics of how Stegosaurus and Ankylosaurus move, or their armored plating or something like that.
Yeah, I've got a whole bunch of projects. We just published a paper last year on flotation in ankylosaurs. You know, they tend to be found belly up. Why?
Oh.
And it turns out that as the carcass starts to decay and gas bloats the belly,
yeah,
they flip over and they float around belly up. And eventually the body goes pop and they sink to the bottom on their backs. Like vast majority of them are on their backs.
Yeah. I guess like the dinosaurs had to die and they had to be preserved. And that's just one part of it, right? So.
Yeah, and to do that, I had to use my physics and math to calculate where's the center of buoyancy, where's the center of mass in the dead body.
Oh, man.
And because there's too many calculations, I end up writing a lot of computer programs to crunch the numbers for me and produce graphics. So that's my geophysics background, the math and the computing coming in as well.
So you do use physics in your daily job. So the high school kids, the high school kids that complain about that, they don't know. There's lots of jobs out there that need that physics background.
Plus, it gives me the ability. I can ask and answer questions that your average paleo type can't, because most of them are innumerate. You hear about illiteracy, but you don't often hear about innumeracy.
So in an average day for you, what do you do as a paleontologist down at the museum? Like, what's an average day? Or is your day so varied it's difficult to kind of track down what you do?
Yeah, sort of roughly from about October to May, I'm in the office or in the lab or down in collections looking at fossils. And in the summer, we tend to be away a lot. Today's actually a pretty good example of what I've had to do today. I'm trying to get a conference abstract ready. Again, looking at feeding in plesiosaurs. That has to be ready by Friday. I'm off to another conference on Thursday, and I just got my poster printed. We got pictures sent today from an interesting fossil site found by kayakers, and we contacted them, and we're thinking about going down and investigating that site.
Where's that? Can you tell us where this site is, or is it top secret?
I think I'll keep it secret for now. We're really worried about poaching.
Yeah, no.
And, you know, people wanting a souvenir.
Yeah.
And all fossils are protected. If it's something good, you'll hear about it eventually.
You betcha. No, I was bugging you. I totally get you would keep it secret. Yeah, you don't want a bunch of people hearing this and then going to that location and wrecking it, right? Because it's there.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So then you'd be in the field and you'd be doing, you know, you're at conferences and you're in the lab and you got some clerical office work you probably got to do. So pretty
very. The other thing was there's a magazine, a children's science magazine. They're actually doing a story on the Borealopelta, that exceptional armored dinosaur from Fort McMurray.
Yeah.
And they want to check on the pictures for their magazine. I also did that this morning.
Oh, neat. That was such a cool story. Like they had the whole thing was like preserved, right? Like skin and everything.
It was 100% complete until it got hit by the excavator bucket.
Oh man. That's
they scooped away the tail. The tail's still up there somewhere, but it would be not worth the effort to go and look for it.
No.
But fortunately we got the face and that awesome front part of the animal.
Oh yeah. So I saw the pictures. It just blew my mind. It's just the coolest thing. If you could narrow it down, what do you like best about being a paleontologist? Like if you could tell kids or other science enthusiasts or other scientists, like what about your job that is it that you love?
Once you get to this level with this level of training and showing, you know, that you can do good science, you're your own boss. Nobody tells me what to do. I get to choose what to work on, where to go and do it, how to do it. Everything is my own decision. I really like that freedom.
That's cool.
It would drive me crazy to be told you're going to do this.
Yeah. Like just thinking of you, I have this mental picture of like a bloated, you know, it's kind of a morbid picture of a bloated dinosaur floating there, but like that was obviously you were curious about that and you just went with it and figured it out.
There's no end of things to do. I've got a list on my wall of projects I want to do. And the list keeps getting longer. It takes time to do good science. Yep. You have to do it carefully. You know, there's no one's done this before, so it's always new. And it takes time to do good science. So things don't happen as fast as you would like.
I hear that a lot. And that's something I always have to tell the public because sometimes I'm a science communicator a bit. And science moves pretty slow. Like you can't rush good science. If you rush it, a lot of mistakes can happen and the whole story is missed and then it becomes a big mess. So, yeah. And
plus it's embarrassing when you made some bonehead oversight.
So one of the things about this podcast is it has an element with dogs too. Do you have any pets yourself?
Well, I've got all my fish, tropical fish, amphibians, and reptiles. No mammals, no birds. No, I think I've got a pretty good dog story.
Oh, awesome. We'd love to hear it.
Doesn't paint the dog in too good a light, though, but it is. Well, I think it's amusing. When I was about 8 or 9, at the end of our street, there was a house with a really big German shepherd.
Yep.
And my friend and I were really frightened of this dog. And we By the time we got near that house, we crossed the other side of the street to get away from him. We called him the Big Bad Wolf. And one day my friend David said, you know, I bet if we speak nicely to it, it'll be okay. So we boldly walk up to him, and my friend David puts out his hand, go to pat him on the head, and says, hello, nice wolf. And the dog chomps him on the arm and tears his jacket.
Oh, no.
So we quickly fled, and we went back to staying on the other side of the street.
And was there any, you guys just decided to leave the dog alone after that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's because, you know, David went to touch him without properly letting him get a smell.
Yeah.
And I guess the dog felt threatened and let him know.
Our dog Bunsen is a Bernese Mountain Dog, and he's been socialized pretty good. So he's, you know, he's pretty affectionate, and he comes into my school and, you know, during exam time, and he works with kids that might have a little bit of stress from exams. But right. if he's approached too rapidly, especially by males, he won't, I don't think he'd ever bite somebody, but he definitely doesn't like that. So there is a knack to approaching dogs, yeah. Especially so.
Wow. My sister is mad for dogs though.
Oh yeah.
Ever since she was little, she's wanted a dog, but my mom wouldn't let them. But now she's got a poodle, a giant thing.
Yeah. Dogs are good. They're a little more maintenance than a reptile in an atrium though. I think I could give you that for sure.
Yeah, I like my animals contained. Controls the mess.
Back to dinosaurs. Yeah. One of the things that I find, I've had two little boys, they're a little bit older now, and I've got a couple nephews, and kids in elementary school, and even adults, they're just fascinated by the whole world of dinosaurs. And the Terrell Museum draws people from all over the world. Like, it's an amazing place. That museum is just crazy cool. Big people become little kids when they see dinosaurs. What is it about dinosaurs that draws people, do you think? Like, what is it? What's the magic of dinosaurs?
Well, what got me when I was younger was they were like monsters that really lived. I've always liked, you know, science fiction, and Doctor Who's been my favorite TV show since I was six. And dinosaurs are like monsters that really lived. You can go and find them. You can figure out how they lived and how they moved. So there's that. But also, I think they're safe monsters. They're separated in time from us. And they look so bizarre. I think they appeal to, that's why I think they appeal to all ages. And then once people get older, they realize it was so long ago. And there was a whole different world so long ago. I think people still have that sense of fascination and just awe at that whole idea that there was these vast worlds, from complete worlds, just like as real as today, but they're all gone. And maybe that's a bit sad too.
Yeah, you do. You know, that's a good point. When I leave that museum, and I've been probably a dozen times in my life, I'm happy that I went, but there's like this feeling of loss and melancholy, a little bit of that, like, just a little bit, not like I'm, you know, I'd be so sad I wouldn't go back, but that's a good point that it's a time that we've lost of creatures yeah. We'll never see again. But your whole study is in that area. So you're bringing back pieces of that for the public, which, man, what a service to kids and their imagination that paleontologists do. That's so cool.
Yeah. I really like the idea that you can, it makes the world a richer place. Like, what we see today is just a tiny slice of the variety of life that's been on Earth. And there's a much bigger picture, and we just fit right into that bigger picture, too.
So one of the things we end the podcast with, and you get a little bit of an extra question at the end, but one of the questions we end with is the super fact. What would be something you would tell somebody that would just blow their mind that you know because of your training as an expert with dinosaurs?
Okay, well, dinosaurs were around for something like 160 million years, and it's hard for people to get their head around that. But I like to tell people that we are closer in time to Tyrannosaurus than Tyrannosaurus was to Allosaurus. Allosaurus was a widespread, large predatory dinosaur at the end of the Jurassic, lived along Stegosaurus and Brontosaurus. Tyrannosaurus is 90 million years away from Allosaurus. And we're only 66 million years away from Tyrannosaurus. I think that gives a sense for how long dinosaurs were around.
Oh my, that's just the deep time of the earth just boggles the mind, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's a cool fact. I love that. I'm going to, with your permission, I'm going to steal that and tell my students, because one of the classes I teach, Science 20, there's a geology component. So if I can steal that fact, that'd be great.
Oh, you're welcome. I didn't invent it. I just have to calculate it.
Oh, okay. So the last question, your special question is, obviously, you have to ask the dinosaur expert what their favorite dinosaur is. And before you give me yours, I'm going to give you mine, and you can laugh or not. But my favorite dinosaur since I've been a kid, and I've got a couple stuffed animals of it, is the Ankylosaurus. I just love that guy. But what's your favorite dinosaur?
Mine has to be Brachiosaurus.
Okay.
It's so big, and it's for its size, it's one of the most complete ones we have. There's bigger things that are related, but we haven't got anything like a complete skeleton. But Brachiosaurus, it's really well known, and we can get a good idea of, you know, how it was put together. And I just like its shape.
And for people that may not know, that's one of the giant plant-eating dinosaurs.
Yeah, with a super long neck. It's also the one the first one you get a good look at in the first Jurassic Park film.
Mm, right.
When it does that bogus getting up onto its hind limbs.
Oh man, that could be a whole podcast of just picking your brain with all of the logical inconsistencies of the Jurassic Park series.
But I liked that scene so much that if the movie ended there, I would have felt I got my money's worth. Because it was such an awesome scene.
Go ahead, sorry.
Mechanically, it doesn't work, though.
I remember, I think I was in grade 9 or 10 when the Jurassic Park movie came out. And I just, I think I watched it 3 or 4 times in the movie theaters. It was just amazing. All right. Well, you know what? I know you're such a busy guy. And I so appreciate you coming on the Science Podcast. And, in a couple months, 3 months, 4 months, would you be willing to be a guest again if you can carve out a half an hour?
I'm sure that'd be fine.
Yeah. And you know what? And again, thank you so much for coming on talking dinosaurs. Thank you so much again.
All right. Bye.
Bye. All right, guys, I've opened up the mailbag and we're ready to read some questions. All right. So the next question in the mailbag comes from Crystal Hughes. What are some unique science issues that you face in your part of the world? By the way, so looking forward to this. Okay, so one issue that we face in Alberta, if you don't know much about Alberta, Alberta is the energy beacon of Canada. We have an enormous amount of coal. We have an enormous amount of natural gas. We have so much natural gas, we export most of it to the northern United States. And we have the oil sands, and through the past 20 years, we figured out ways to get the oil out of the sand. It's like this oily, gross sand, and we figured out ways to get oil out of it. One of the things we face is that a large percentage of people in Alberta require, like, their jobs are tied to oil. Their jobs are tied to carbon. With that, you have some challenges. Now, I'm a realist. Alberta is extremely cold in the winter. So Alberta just can't switch to renewables like other warmer climates. We have to be able to heat our homes in the winter. It's impossible to heat our homes with current technology. It'd be really, really expensive. But one of the things that also happens is when you have a lot of people whose jobs rely on carbon, is there's a lot of pushback against anything that's kind of green. Not everybody, but there's some pushback, and there's perhaps, because of that, more climate change denial. So that's an issue for us right now.
Another science issue for us is that in our area, there are ticks which cause big diseases like Lyme disease and stuff. So if you were to go out without proper protection against Lyme disease, you would get very sick and possibly die from it. So maybe we should have more advancements in the medication, have maybe a drug that can kill Lyme disease quicker than other ones, which people might be resistant to. All right, so the next question comes from Eric, the King of Scots, on Twitter. I know Bunsen is a good boy, but nobody's perfect. What's the most trouble Bunsen has ever gotten himself into? All right, so there's a story. I think Mom would tell it better, but there's a story, and I'll let my mom tell this one.
So I was working really hard. I got this new strawberry plant planter, and I was really excited about putting the plants on my deck, and I was going to have all these strawberries, and I planted them all. And I thought, wait, hey, why not? Let's just leave Bunsen out on the deck. He's enjoying it. I went inside for a few minutes, and I went outside, and he had ripped all of the strawberries out of the pot. And the dirt was everywhere, and his paws were dirty, and his mouth had a little green strawberry plant hanging out. And I was like, what happened here?
Should have took a picture of that.
I did.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that's the most trouble he got in with me.
Okay, Adam, what about you?
I would say today, because there was our grandpa's dog outside, and Bunsen jumped through the door and ran as fast as he could all the way up to my grandpa's house.
What's the dog?
Doc. His name is Doc.
Yeah. And so if you follow Bunsen on Twitter, you've probably seen pictures of Doc. He's a little miniature schnauzer, and Bunsen and Doc just love each other. Well, I think Bunsen likes Doc more than Doc likes Bunsen.
Maybe a little. I don't know if it's mutual.
Yeah. Bunsen really likes dogs. Well, with me, the biggest trouble he ever got into, he's actually not a destructive dog, really. But we don't keep the garbage out where he can get it, and I forgot to put the garbage away. And he's only shredded the garbage one time, and it was the one time I left the garbage out. And he tore it apart, and there was a huge mess from the garbage. But that was my mistake. Really, any dog, if you give them temptation, they're probably going to act on that unless you've specifically trained them not to touch like the things like the garbage. And that's the mailbag. Okay, time to close the mailbag, Adam.
All right, let me grab it. Ugh, it's kind of heavy.
I know.
Time to close the mailbag.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's Science Podcast. We are so happy you were listening. Special thanks to Dr. Donald Henderson from the Royal Tyrrell Museum as he took time out of his busy week to talk to us about dinosaurs. Until next week, let's remember Bunsen's motto, for science, empathy, and cuteness.